Just to give you some context, we've known for some while that we wanted to study one of the books of the Bible as a study, and Harvey and I both were fairly clear what we wanted to look at, so we both went away, and we both came back to a meeting. I remember the meeting on a Wednesday in our lounge, and Harvey said, actually, I think we shouldn't be looking at the book of Romans or the book of Acts, we should be looking at the book of Philippians. And I said, well, that's really interesting, because I've been looking, and I don't think we should look at the book of Romans or the book of Acts, I think we should be looking at the book of Philippians. And we both got this revelation that this short book, and part of the reason was that Tracy gave us a word right at the beginning of the year about joy. And Philippians has joy writ large through the entirety of it. Philippians, the book, was written in roughly AD 55, AD 60, something like that. So we're talking approximately 30 years or thereabouts after the death and resurrection of Jesus. Now that makes it really very, very close. Personal memories. If I asked you now, how many of you can remember things that happened in the 1990s? It's sort of fairly recent, isn't it? Well, if you're like me, it feels fairly recent. And Philippians was written by the Apostle Paul to encourage a persecuted church in a colony called Philippi. Paul had visited them. He'd established a church some 10 to 15 years previously. And Paul is now in prison and is suffering too. But he writes about joy. 16 times at least in this short book, you'll see the word joy mentioned. Philippi is a small town. It's in the province of Macedonia, which is northeastern Greece. And in 42 BC, there was a really significant battle that happened at Philippi. And this battle led to Augustus becoming the new Roman emperor. And because this battle was so significant, Augustus gave Philippi the privilege of being a Roman colony. Those special privileges offered all the rights, all the favours, all of the luxuries of being in Rome itself. So this became a very, very attractive place to settle, especially for Roman veterans who were fiercely loyal to Rome. And they came from all over the area to settle in this wonderful town of Philippi, which was about 10 miles from the coast. But any non-Romans would have been looked down on. Any non-Romans would have sort of been almost second-class citizens. And so this Philippi is Rome in all but geography. And the new Christian church that has been established by Paul faced considerable hostility. So as I said, it's about 10 years since Paul established the church. And he hears of the plight of the church from prison. And he hears of their plight in terms of persecution. But they hear of Paul's plight being in prison. And in those days, there was no sort of meals and hot and cold running water, a toilet and food delivered to your cell. You were absolutely dependent on others to look after you if you're in prison. So the church in Philippi, even though they are in the midst of hardship, take up an offering, a sacrificial offering to help care for Paul's needs. And when Paul writes back to them to say thank you, this is the letter that he sent. The letter to the Philippians is the letter that we read. We're going to look at it in detail over the next 7 weeks, obviously not next week, but thereafter. And one of the things you'll notice, this theme of joy. Paul talks about joy in suffering, joy in serving, joy in believing, joy in giving. In fact, all the way through, you'll notice how Paul says, take joy, be joyous. But where does he start? Much of what we've been singing today. Paul starts his letter like this. He says, may God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ give you grace and peace. He says, every time I think of you, I give thanks to my God. Whenever I pray, I make requests for all of you with joy. For you have been my partners in spreading the good news about Christ from the time you first heard about it until now. And I am certain, I love this verse, I am certain that God who began the good work within you will continue his work until it is finally finished on the day when Jesus Christ returns. And if Paul writes that for the book of Philippi, he writes it to you too, that the God who started a good work in you will see it through to completion. And then he goes on a bit, and in a bit he says, I pray that your love will overflow more and more, and that you will keep on growing in knowledge and understanding, for I want you to understand what really matters. I want you to understand what really matters so that you may live pure and blameless lives until the day of Christ's return. May you always be filled with the fruit of your salvation, the righteous character produced in your life by Jesus Christ, for this will bring much glory and praise to God. That's how he's setting it up. And so what I'm going to do now is we're going to play a short video. This video will explain the overall structure of the book. I'm going to invite Mary to come and do the second half of this talk.
Paul's letter to the Philippians. The church in Philippi was the first Jesus community Paul started in Eastern Europe, and that story is told in Acts chapter 16. Philippi was a Roman colony in ancient Macedonia. It was full of retired soldiers, and it was known for its patriotic nationalism. And so there, Paul faced resistance when he was announcing Jesus as the true king of the world. And after Paul moved on from there, those who became followers of Jesus continued to suffer resistance and even persecution, but they remained a vibrant community faithful to the way of Jesus. Paul sent this letter from one of his many imprisonments, and for a very practical reason. The Philippians had sent one of their members, Epaphroditus, to take a financial gift to Paul to support him in prison. And Paul sent back this letter with Epaphroditus to say thank you and to do a whole lot more. The design of this letter doesn't develop one single idea from beginning to end like many of Paul's other letters. Rather, Paul has arranged a series of short, reflective essays or vignettes, and they all revolve around the center of gravity in this letter, which is a poem in chapter 2. It artistically retells the story of the Messiah's incarnation, his life, death, and resurrection, and exaltation. And then in each of these vignettes, Paul will take up key words or ideas from that poem to show how living as a Christian means seeing your own story as a lived expression of Jesus' story. So Paul opens the letter with a prayer of gratefulness, and he thanks God for the Philippians' generosity, for their faithfulness, and he expresses his confidence that the life-transforming work that God has begun in them will continue into greater and more beautiful expressions of faithfulness and love. And Paul then focuses on their obvious concern at the moment, which is his status in prison. Being in a Roman prison was no picnic, but it paradoxically has turned out for good to advance the good news about Jesus. So all of the Roman guards, the administrators, they all know that Paul's in prison for announcing Jesus as the risen Lord. And his imprisonment, it's inspired confidence in other Christians to talk about Jesus more openly. And Paul's optimistic that he will be released from prison, but it's possible that he could be executed. And as he reflects on it, that actually wouldn't be so bad, because for me, Paul says, life is the Messiah. And so dying would be a gain. For Paul, his life in the present and in the future, it's defined by the life and love of Jesus for him. And so if he's executed, that means he'll be present with Jesus, which would be great for him. And if he's released, well, that would mean he could keep working to start more Jesus communities, which would be better for other people. And so that's what he hopes for. And notice how his train of thought works here. Dying for Jesus is not the true sacrifice for Paul. Rather, it's staying alive to serve others. And so that's Paul's way of participating in the story of Jesus, to suffer in order to love others more than himself. Paul then turns to the Philippians, and he urges them to participate in Jesus' example by taking up this same mindset. He says, your life as citizens should be consistent with the good news about the Messiah. So these Christians in Philippi, they were living in a hotbed of Roman patriotism, but their way of life was to be shaped by another king, Jesus. And that might bring persecution, but they are not to be afraid, because suffering for being associated with Jesus, it's a way of living out the story of Jesus himself. Which leads Paul into the great poem of chapter 2. It's rich with echoes of Old Testament text, specifically the story of Adam and his rebellion in Genesis 1 through 3, and the poems about the suffering servant in the book of Isaiah. This poem is worth committing to memory. It is a beautifully condensed version of the gospel story. So before becoming human, the Messiah pre-existed in a state of glory and equality with God. And unlike Adam, who tried to seize equality with God, the Messiah chose not to exploit his equal status for his self-advantage. Rather, he emptied himself of status. He became a human. He became a servant to all. And even more than that, he allowed himself to be humiliated. He was obedient to the Father by going to his death on a Roman execution rack. But through God's power and grace, the Messiah's shameful death has been reversed through the resurrection. And now God has highly exalted Jesus as the King of all, bestowing upon him the name that is above all names, so that all creation should recognize that Jesus the Messiah is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Now, that last statement is astounding. Paul's quoting from Isaiah chapter 45. It's a passage where all creation comes to recognize the God of Israel as Lord. Paul's point here is very clear. In the crucified and risen Jesus, we discover that the one true God of Israel consists of God the Father and the Lord Jesus. And so for Paul, this poem, it expresses his convictions about who Jesus is, and it does more. It offers the example of Jesus as a way of life that his followers are to imitate. And so that's why Paul immediately goes on to tell two stories, first about Timothy, then about Epaphroditus, because they are both examples of people living out Jesus' story. So Timothy's like Jesus because he's constantly concerned for the well-being of other people more than his own. And Epaphroditus, who the Philippians sent with their gift, he ended up risking his life to serve Paul in prison. He got so sick he almost died trying to help Paul. But God had mercy on him and Paul by sparing him the loss of a friend. Paul's point here is that these are the kinds of people who are living, breathing examples of the story of Jesus, and they are worthy of imitation. Paul then turns to his own story as an example. So those Christians who had been demanding circumcision of non-Jewish Christians, remember his letter to the Galatians, these people are still stirring up trouble for Paul, and they keep reminding him of his own past, when he used to persecute Jesus' followers, when he tried to show his right standing before God by his zealous obedience to the laws of the Torah. But like Jesus, Paul has given up all of that status and privilege. He now regards all of it as filth, and the word he uses is actually much less polite. He's given it all up to become a servant, like Jesus, to participate in his suffering and sacrificial love. And he does all of it in the hope that Jesus' love will carry him through death and out the other side into resurrection. So Paul says that for followers of Jesus, their true citizenship is in heaven, which for Paul does not mean that we should all hope to get away from earth and go to heaven one day. Rather, heaven is the transcendent place where Jesus reigns as king. And he says we're eagerly awaiting our royal Savior to come from there and return here to bring his kingdom of healing justice and transforming love to bring about a new creation. Paul then challenges the Philippians to keep living out the Jesus story. He first addresses two prominent women leaders in the church who worked alongside Paul, and they're in some kind of conflict. And so Paul pleads with them to follow Jesus' example of humility, to reconcile and become unified. Paul then urges the Philippians not to give in to fear, but despite their persecution, to vent all of their emotion and their needs to God, who will give them peace. And that peace, Paul says, it comes by focusing your thoughts on what is good and true and lovely. There's always something that you could complain about, but a follower of Jesus knows that all of life is a gift and can choose to see beauty and grace in any life circumstance. Which leads Paul to his conclusion. He again thanks the Philippians for their sacrificial gift, and he wants them to know that his imprisonments, that his times of poverty, that these are not true hardships for him. They've actually become his greatest teachers, showing him that no matter his circumstances, he has learned the secret of contentment, its simple dependence on the one who strengthens him. Paul has come to see his own suffering as a participation in the story of Jesus. The letter to the Philippians gives us a unique window into Paul's own heart and mind. He saw his entire life as a reenactment of the story of Jesus. And you can sense in this letter his close connection to Jesus, his awareness that Jesus' love and presence is closer than his own skin. And that's what gave him hope and humility in his darkest hours. And so Paul shows us that knowing Jesus is always a deeply personal, transforming encounter. That's the kind of Jesus that Paul invites others to follow. And that's what Paul's letter to the Philippians is all about.
So as Martin said, Paul's letter to the Philippians, it's been described as the epistle of excellent things and the epistle of joy. And it's quite curious, as we saw in that video, that the author of an epistle of excellent things and joy is writing from a situation that I think most of us would consider to be anything other than excellent or joyous. You know, he's imprisoned, most probably in Rome. He's writing to the church in Philippi, and that church in Philippi, he makes clear that they're really special. They're really special friends to him, more than any of the other churches. He tells them so. He says, "You're the only ones that I allowed to help me with a gift of money." And they're really precious. And the letter, it jumps around. It's a newsy letter. It's a letter of someone who's talking to his friends. But he can't travel to meet them. He says that he has confidence that he will see them again. But right now he's stuck. He's stuck in one place until such time as his case may come to trial. So we've got Paul, great evangelist. He's travelled around the regions bringing the gospel to the Gentiles, to the non-Jewish people. You know, he's been zealous. He's set up this church in Philippi. And he had such knowledge of God, and God had revealed insights to Paul. He'd given him visions and revelations about God's own nature so that Paul could share those and reveal them to others. And he's this incredible communicator. He's got this wisdom and this, he's been this path to salvation for so many people, including that church at Philippi, the very first church to be set up in Europe. So I kind of think, I feel a little bit about the church in Philippi, that it's a little pathway for us. It's part of our own stage to hearing the good news about Christ. And we might be forgiven if our natural reaction is to think that Paul's imprisonment might reduce his ability to spread the gospel. But no. Paul says in verse 12, "Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel." He's stuck in prison, and it's helped advance the gospel. And Paul says twice in this passage from Philippians that he's in chains. And obviously we know that he's imprisoned. But actually he uses a specific type of word, halusis, that means a particular type of chain. And this was a really short length of chain that attached a prisoner to the wrist of their guard, of the soldier who was guarding them. And that meant that the prisoner couldn't escape if they were attached. So Paul might have been the prisoner and the captive, but quite frankly, so too was each soldier who took their turn guarding him as they were attached to him, by the wrist. I mean, Paul might have been the prisoner, but he really did have a captive audience. Just think, they'd have rotated, they'd have all taken their turns, and every time Paul had someone new who was being paid to spend time with Paul and listen to the gospel. Time where Paul could preach, but also answer questions and understand each person. He'd have got to know them. And these weren't just any old guards. Paul was guarded by the Praetorian Guard, and they were an elite unit of the Imperial Guard of Rome. The Imperial Guard of Rome and the Praetorian Guards in particular, they had power, they had influence. Later on, Roman emperors, they found them a real headache because they wielded the power. They could seat and unseat emperors. Whoever they said was the next emperor, they were the next emperor. And that guard, they provided bodyguards, personal bodyguards and intelligence for the emperor himself. That unit had direct access to the emperor of Rome. And these were the people that Paul had one at a time as his captive audience to share the good news of Christ to. And so Paul doesn't, he doesn't suggest that he's not suffering. He doesn't say that his life is just one big happy bundle of fun. But in the middle of his suffering, he's able to find joy. And he says that he rejoices because the gospel is being preached. And if I think about my own life, about times when things have been difficult and tough, I do genuinely see that there is joy amongst the difficulties. It's in those periods where things are hardest that the blessings from God have been so numerous and so countless. And it doesn't downplay suffering or lessen it. But when we're reduced to situations where there is nothing that we can do to control the outcome, it's then that we can place ourselves fully and wholly in God's hands. And in doing so, we give him more ways to bless us. And so often when we try to kind of fix things ourselves or even understand a situation that we can't fix in our own understanding, we end up feeling worse. And we don't give God complete power over everything. And so we limit him. I'm going to tell you about James. Some of you know this story or bits of it. But I think some of the things that we went through with James is some of the hardest things that we've had to face as a family. He knows that I'm telling you this. I asked his permission first. He's not here this morning because he's just got back from 3 days camping in woods at a Christian camp with no showers. So we thought that we'd, yeah. For everyone's sake. But, you know, his story has a happy ending. And I know that not everyone does get to have a happy ending. And the pain of loss and suffering may not always subside completely in our lifetimes. But I do know that whatever situation we are in, at every moment, God truly cares. Jesus wept when he lost his friend Lazarus, even though he then raised him from the dead. And Jesus was in so much anguish when he was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane before his arrest that he sweated blood. We have a God who doesn't stay removed or detached from the sorrows life can bring, but who loves us and wants to help us, both in our joys and in our suffering. But going back to James. James was born perfectly fine. No reason to suspect that, you know, there was anything that would happen other than we were going to have our nice little baby, you know, healthy 7 pounds 5 ounces, and we'd take him home in a couple of days to his big sister, who was just turned 2. And he was born, and you know, handed to us, and that was you know, what we thought would happen. And about 3 hours later, he was admitted to the neonatal ICU with hypothermia and very low oxygen levels. And after that, my husband Al saw him in the ICU, but I was stuck, I'd had a cesarean, so the only thing I had of James after that was a little photo that was sent up from the ICU of him. It's actually the best he looked for about 2 months after that, but that was all I had. And so I didn't see him again until about 10:30, 11 o'clock that night. And they wheeled me down to see him. And by that point, he was on a ventilator and covered in tubes. And the doctor on duty made it clear that they weren't sure he was going to make it through the night. And so I was wheeled back. And I was stuck. I'd had a baby. And I felt it was my duty and my job and my responsibility to do everything I could to look after him. But I wasn't I wasn't even on the same floor of the hospital as him now. And I've never been great at asking for help. But the only thing I could do was, the only thing I could do to help James was to place James in God's hands, to send out requests for prayer, and to know that, to know that I'd given James to the one person who could help him. But that, it wasn't about feeling awkward or imposing on people. By asking for all the prayer I could for James, it meant that I'd handed him over to God. And then I went to sleep, and I could go to sleep, not knowing what the morning would bring, but knowing that I'd done everything that I could for James, and there was nothing more for me to do. And, there was a real sense of relief. There was a sense of relief knowing that I couldn't do any more, but knowing that there were other people praying for James too. And James was born on the 30th of December, so the next day was New Year's Eve, and our church had planned a great big New Year's Eve party. And instead, they gave the whole party over to praying for James. And he was passed to various friends, family. And we had churches all over the country. We had churches all over the world praying for James. We had America and Germany and India and the Philippines. And I forget the rest. I mean, I remember trying to work it out, how many people, and I couldn't. I knew that it ran into the hundreds of thousands. And even after it was confirmed that James has a really rare genetic condition, it's called ABCA3 surfactant deficiency, for anyone who... it's not even common enough to have a name. When he was born, there were only 9 previous cases in the UK confirmed. And of those cases, none who had symptoms at birth had survived more than 28 days. And we were told it was impossible for James to live more than 28 days. Nobody had. We think in the world. And we agreed to a do not resuscitate order for him. And as he got closer to 28 days, he got sicker. Until eventually there was an afternoon where he couldn't keep his oxygen levels up. They were hovering around 40% and dropping. And that was when they switched off all the machines that were supporting him. And they gave him to me to hold. And we sat there, and I held him. And after about 1.5, 2 hours, they said, "Would you mind if we just put the machines back on just to have a quick look and see how he's doing?" And he was on 100% oxygen. And, by this point, it's about 1 a.m. in the morning, so at that point, we sort of put him back, and we all went to bed and kind of waited to see what was going to happen next. And so, all the way through, we've been told, medically speaking, that if we ever took him home, it would only be for a couple of weeks, and then we'd be straight back to the ICU. We were told he'd been deprived of oxygen so long he would have severe development difficulties. No one's mentioned those when he walked at 6 months. I should have been grateful, but 6 months was, quite frankly, difficult. We used to have at the church, we used to have men posted on every door because he was so much smaller that he could get through all the people faster than anyone could chase him. We were told he wouldn't make it to age 2, which was the minimum age he could be assessed and put on the list for a heart and lung transplant. And when he got to H2, we weren't being assessed. We were agreeing with the hospital consultant that he'd be temporarily discharged, as quite frankly, there was no reason to go and see them anymore. We don't know. You know, at any stage, we don't know what will happen. It's a progressive disease. But quite frankly, James has defied so many odds. But he's done it. He's done it with God's help. I mean, this you know, as impossible goes, it was just, you know, it's been incredible. But the situation we went through with James, it's left me with more blessings than just having him still. And Paul talks about, and sort of the sort of theme around this is joy in suffering. And that means that we can have the two together. When I think of the months we spent in various hospitals with James, I think not of the uncertainty and the different times that we thought we were saying goodbye to him, but of all the other blessings we received that brought real joy. You know, the play specialists who looked after Emily. You know, the fact that of all the hospitals in the country, he got moved to Leicester, where my friend who was on maternity leave was a mile away and so could come and help. She had Emily and my mum sleeping on her sofa one night when we were stranded with snow but the messages and the prayers and the gifts from our church family and the family who cared enough not just to pray themselves but to tell others and ask them to pray. And the real heart shown to us by so many people. And there were lots of tears and there were lots of difficult decisions. And more than one moment when we were told that, humanly speaking, there was no hope. But the love that we were shown by so many people, some of whom we knew but many who we didn't, was a real blessing and really did bring us joy. God's brought us this far with James, and we celebrate the blessings we've had so far and we place the future in God's hands, knowing there is no safer place. And I think those are the blessings that Paul was feeling as well when he was in jail. The Philippians, they'd collected money to support him. They were thinking about him. They may have been far away. You know, he'd been there a while back, he'd set up the church, but you know, lots of them wouldn't have necessarily met him or known him, but they still cared. I think as well that I certainly feel blessed that whatever else may be going on, however tough life gets, James's presence, it's a kind of a constant reminder to me of God's power and his goodness and his faithfulness. And I look at James and I think, well, God, if you can do that, you can do anything. And I think when things are tough or when life brings struggles, as it does, we need reminders. We need these reminders of God's faithfulness and goodness to bring our focus back to him and to give us that peace and reassurance in that moments when it's harder to see God's plan in the situation we're in. And I would urge all of us to literally build up that memory bank. That memory bank of God's goodness. Whatever works, write it down, make a note in your phone, whatever works. Write down a list of those times and occasions when God's really taken charge in your life or in the lives of others that mean something to you, that will act as a comfort and a reminder to you, and have them ready for the tough times so that when life gets tough, and it will, you've got them to help cement your trust in God and help you just get through. And life will have those moments of suffering. Jesus said, I've come. Okay, it's not working. Jesus said, I've come in order that you might have life. Life in all its fullness. And that means life that is eternal. That's more than simply the lives that we lead here on earth. We have eternal life through the salvation we have been offered by Jesus' death and resurrection. But I believe there's more to fullness of life than eternal life. It's also about the quality of our lives right now. Going back to James's start in life, Al, my husband, and I, we had to make decisions that we'd never expected to face. And once we believed there was a chance that we might bring him home, we had to think what that looked like. And with the wonderful power of the internet, you know, we know the other eight people with this condition. And some have chosen to homeschool to protect their child from infection. And that, you know, there is no right or wrong in this, but we, though, we felt that James had fought, and he had, and it was visible. You could see him fighting. He'd fought to live. And that fullness of life meant we wanted him to experience as much of life as possible. And fullness of life meant we had to take a risk in God's hands. But in order to be able to take him out and about, for him to be able to make friends and socialise, we could have kept him safe at home, locked away, to reduce the risk. But then we'd have failed him. The life that he'd fought for, the life that God given him here on earth, would not have been life in all its fullness. It would have been a narrow life. Safe, but not life in all its fullness. And I think the same is true of our own lives. If we're to have life in all its fullness, that means we risk suffering. To experience grief, we first have to have loved. To develop wisdom, we so often have to learn from our mistakes. To experience joy, we risk suffering. Otherwise, we sign up not for fullness of life, but for a monotone existence. If we try to avoid the lows, then we miss out on the highs too. And Jesus fought for us. He came so we could have life in all its fullness. And in Philippians, Paul talks about his fellow believers having the confidence to spread the gospel. Confidence because he is suffering. And I won't pretend that I find his words easy to understand. He writes, "Because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear." So because Paul is suffering, others have been empowered. Now, maybe they've seen the favourable impression Paul's made on the guards. Maybe he's seen the joy that Paul is still able to share whilst he's suffering. They could have seen just how much Paul had done. The word he uses means progress. He's still progressed the gospel in captivity. Maybe, you know, how much more might they do who were free to spread the gospel where they were? So just as Paul reflects on his current situation, not downplaying his suffering, but rejoicing in the progress of the gospel that's being made, not simply despite his imprisonment, but actively because of it. He looks forward then to the future. He not only focuses on joy and the progress of the gospel again, but he adds to these trust and confidence. And Paul says to the Philippians, "Yes, and I will continue to rejoice. For I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance." And the prayers of that community are so important. Paul has confidence in them. My experience with James and other times is that when things have been tough, a praying family of the church does really bring joy. Doesn't change the fact suffering's happening, but it does bring blessings and joy in the middle of that suffering. And not just through prayers, but practical help as well. You know, I smile equally for the message from a 90-year-old's grandson who was desperate to get news of James because she was going to have a prayer meeting for him that afternoon, just as much as the lovely family who gave Emily some princess slippers to help her. And it's they're both equally valuable. Because they cared. And we can do that for each other. Just as Paul has had confidence from the Philippians, and they he has joy. We can, in this church family, in the wider family of the church in Stroud and beyond, by sharing the joy of Christ's love within us, in prayers and practically, and just listening sometimes to those who may be suffering. And I want to end by sharing a message that God gave to me last week here in church. And I was sitting up in the balcony, and through the window I could see a sort of dull wall, and in front were, I think they've been cut down now, but they looked like overgrown weeds. But there were also some beautiful pink flowers. Not many, but they were there. And I felt God say, look at my beautiful flowers that I made. Aren't they uplifting? As you look on each one, every individual flower brings joy and gives me glory. They look all the more beautiful because they are surrounded by the drab and the ugly. So too do my children shine brighter in the midst of this ugly world. When my children shine with the light of Christ, they will draw attention away from the dirt and the ugly things of this world. Just as the flowers draw your attention, keeping you coming back to focus on them rather than the bare wall and weeds, so too do my children who take my light into the world around them bring attention to my glory. They are beautiful and bring me pleasure and delight. And so, that's us. It may not be easy. Paul didn't have it easy. But we can bring God pleasure and delight. We can share his joy. We can reflect his light. And so it's joy in suffering. It's not instead of necessarily. But the blessings are there. The joy is there. And he is faithful. The band are going to come back in a moment. And we're going to sing about the goodness of God. And there's a line in it that says, all my life you have been faithful. All my life you have been so, so good. And I would just urge each of you, every time I sing that line, I think of James. But I would urge each of you to think of something. Think of a moment when that you can cling on to, that God has really shown his love and his faithfulness in your lives. And give him praise and thanks.